Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Motivational Intelligence Podcast. I'm Sean Johnson, and on this podcast, it's our job to deconstruct for you what makes people and organizations successful. And we got a treat of an interview for you today. We had Frank Buono in the studio. Frank is the president of Next Ad Agency, a division of CGI Communications, and he's been a fixture at CGI since it started in 1988, helping to grow annual revenues from $0 to nearly $50 million today. So this interview covers his journey and the lessons he's learned along the way, namely how trust, loyalty, and destroying doubt have been the keys to his success and the company's success. His path through CGI, this is from his bio, his path through CGI has been characterized by his philosophy of, I would rather beg for forgiveness than ask for permission, I feel you, Frank, and unrivaled driving passion. As a leader of Next since its onset in 2010, Frank brings his passion to his clients and his team. Frank resides in Webster, New York, where he lives with his three sons, Michael, Jeffrey, and Eric. In his free time, Frank can be found skiing, boating, biking, and participating in anything outdoors. He also loves watching and playing sports with his friends and family while exploring his passion for red wine. Frank hopes to be an advocate for Main Street businesses, watching their backs and always keeping them ahead of the curve with new technology and marketing trends. So I think this is going to be a really great interview for you to enjoy. It's great lessons, leadership lessons along the way. And please reach out to us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. And feel free and please do share this interview with anybody you think would find it valuable. Until next time, please enjoy this episode.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at Too Logical. Too Logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. Too Logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with: Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs or just want to say hey, head over to TooLogical.com.
Well, hello, everybody. We have a very special guest today. We have Frank Buono with us, and Frank has a pretty incredible story in life, actually. He's a gentleman who helped to co-found an organization that has a very unique approach. They leverage what they call authority marketing. They are what they refer to themselves as a digital media factory. And in many ways, we're a pioneer in that field long before the likes of companies like YouTube and organizations like that, and very much working in what in many cases can be an underserved market in small and mid-sized companies. They support those organizations. They built a wonderful organization. They about 350 employees now, offices across six states. A pretty neat success story. So, Frank, welcome.
Great to be here, Dave, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, you've worked hard to earn it. So Frank, why don't we kind of start in the beginning? I mean,
sure.
I know you mentioned in one of our earlier conversations that you and Bob, your other co-founder, mm-hmm. You guys met when you were in college in Connecticut.
We did meet in college.
Did you grow up in Connecticut?
I grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut.
All right.
And though I did meet Bob, our CEO, in college, it was actually, and we really have kind of come full circle with just our most. We're actually acquiring a company right now, which brings us full circle. But in sometime around 1986, shortly after I got out of college, I was working at a local family deli back in my hometown. Okay. I ran into Bob at the bank.
Huh.
And in those days, you cashed your check at the bank.
Right.
And I didn't know him well, but I see him cashing his paycheck. And I'm like, damn, that's a hefty paycheck.
Yeah.
So we learned about what he was doing. And as it turns out, he was selling advertising, directory advertising, under the umbrella of the Better Business Bureau. So you alluded to authority marketing or authority advertising. So it was having that third-party endorsement. So I took a position there as a straight commissioned salesperson. Went out on my first sales call, and I think I earned more than I normally would earn in a month on one call.
Wow.
And so pretty much got hooked. And then it was not long after, through a series of events, we ended up with a being in Western New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Buffalo. Bob was in Rochester. We had another guy in Syracuse. And not long after that, we started what was called Community Graphics at the time, which became CGI Communications. We sold cartoon maps. Drawing of buildings with business logos, and we would go into any community from Des Plaines, Illinois, to Fairport, New York, to you name it, Waltham, Massachusetts, and we would create these cartoon maps, and we would have 100 to 150 local businesses involved. So we learned very quickly in the power of small businesses,
right.
Because one of those maps would represent about $50,000 in advertising back then.
Okay. All right. So did you, when you were growing up, did you have aspirations to be an entrepreneur? Did you go to school for something?
I don't know that I would call it being an entrepreneur. I mean, I had a marketing degree.
Okay.
I think, you know, again, I don't know that anybody has anything really formed at 17, 18, 20, 22, 32. But I always thought, you know, wait, I either wanted to be a sportscaster,
right?
Because I really liked sports. That seemed, or own a sports shop,
right?
You know, because selling baseball gloves and skis are all things I like to do, and so I had aspirations for that. Or possibly, I worked in a family deli that wasn't my family, but spent 8 years there.
Okay.
Unique fun fact about me: I've only had 3 jobs in my life, truly only 3. But I thought I would own a sporting goods store or possibly a deli.
Okay.
I saw myself doing that. And then this, you know, life kind of unfolds and this opportunity came along. And I was like, yeah, sure, Bob, let's go. I'm with you.
So, that's a seemingly a fairly big risk, right? You were young, so obviously you don't have the same.
I was 23 years old. Although I had gotten engaged recently, it wasn't a huge financial risk. It was a 5-year plan. We're going to go make millions and head back to Connecticut a short while later. And here we are 30 plus years.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah.
Mostly fun.
Well, you know,
and challenges are fun too.
Exactly. Especially
it's really where the reward comes from.
Yeah. Especially when you have the benefit of hindsight. You know, it's when you're in the throes of it, it's not as much fun.
Right,
but
sure.
After the fact, it's a lot. So talk to us a little bit. You know, about those early years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so you mentioned that's, you know, basically 3 people who are, you know, starting this in essence from a kitchen table, it sounds
sure.
a little bit like. And
pretty much.
And so what were those early years like? How did you, were you successful right from day one, or were there the lean years that you kind of had to fight your way through?
We always made enough to live.
Okay.
Truthfully, there was never a time. I mean, there were some challenging moments where you're like, okay, you know, but always had a paycheck in a sense because we earned what we sold. So we always believed we could sell our way out of problems. So if I can give anybody advice, you can have the best products, you can have the best company, but if you don't have anyone selling it,
right,
you're going to struggle. Things don't sell themselves.
Yeah.
And I think. So we were always paranoid about that, driving new business.
Yeah.
And I think that served us well. And again, it was also that coupled with being relevant. So while we always believed in being niche. So mm-hmm. back in those days, we had a niche. We had a product that no one else was really selling.
Right.
There was tons of people selling advertising, mm-hmm. but we were the only ones doing this. And then we had our authority partnerships with the countless cities and mayor's office. So that put us in a different category. And
right.
that worked and served us well. So we're rolling up to 1999, 2000, 2001. And we were introduced to this CD-ROM that had a series of videos about a city
mm-hmm.
on real estate, education, and healthcare. a welcome video, and that became our flagship product not long after. A series of videos about a community, which we then took this concept and sold advertising to local businesses around it. And that really started in 2003.
Okay.
So long before Google Video or YouTube, certainly, we made, and Bob was brilliant here in forcing us to go to video on the internet.
Okay.
It's commonplace today, of course.
Sure.
You can't live without it. But we made a really strong decision to start moving our company. So we were, you know, we were a $5 million print company in 2003 or so, and we started shifting to digital. We had a really tough year in 2002, 2003. A little bit of growing pains and our own stupidity. A little bit of 9/11, although I will also say that we never bought into reasons for not doing well. Tough to always point the finger at yourself, because sometimes you can point the finger at yourself and not really believe it.
Sure.
But we would look really hard and say, you know, this is our fault. It doesn't have anything to do with tax season. It has nothing to do with the holidays. It has nothing to do with the economy. That's not why we're not doing well, because of us.
Yeah.
We have to figure it out. Either work harder, work smarter, whatever you want to do. But not long after 9/11, we went through some challenges. We had gotten a little fat. We weren't really understanding how P&L statements work and some fundamental math.
Right.
And so we woke up one day, and our CFO and myself and Bob sat down, and we said, well, we're probably backwards about $1.4 million. We had sold a bunch of stuff and hadn't delivered it.
Right.
So we had a real decision to make. Either we could say goodbye, or we could figure out how to pay that $1.4 million down while still getting everyone paid. And our CFO laid out a plan that said, this was the number we got it hit, and everyone will get paid, and we'll take care of all of our quote-unquote debt.
Right.
And Bob went out with one of our guys, Jim Podanowski, and recruited like a madman, and I went out and got acquisitions or contracts with cities.
Okay.
And we basically came back in October, and we're like, okay, we came in at the end of the year, we ended up doing 7-4.
Okay.
And so we took care of what we needed to. We were big boys. We took care of the contingent liability and, in essence, haven't looked back.
Right.
By 2005, we were fully immersed in video on the internet. So this, again, this goes back to the days of dial-up.
Yeah.
So forget video on the internet. Just websites were almost new.
Exactly, like, yeah.
The idea of putting video content is unfathomable in comparison to today, because if you could get a video to play, and I know we're not in front of people right now, but if the video screen was a 2-inch by 2-inch box that would buffer for about 3 minutes, if it would even play. But we worked toward that and actually have several patents around streaming video technology.
Really? And I didn't know that.
And video and identifying your preferred media player. So back in the day, if you were playing a video on a Mac, for example, it would go to QuickTime. You would have to select it.
Okay.
You probably remember that.
Yep.
You'd have to choose your internet speed, whether you were on DSL, broadband, dial-up. But we had a recognition software that identified that for the end user. So that was an innovative move for us. And we launched that product, and it's still that internet product of video with community videos, with local businesses sponsoring those videos. It's still in play today. Still in play today, some 18 years later.
Isn't that incredible. So here you are. You're coming out of a tough time. You're getting, you know, the company back on solid financial footing, and you're totally changing the direction of the way that you guys were moving more towards that more of a video focus.
Mm-hmm.
Was it because one of the challenges that organizations always face when they're kind of in those transition phases is getting people to buy into that. So you'd built a workforce that was, you know, they were accustomed to moving one way, and now you're kind of changing the direction of the organization. How did you get, did you have problems getting people to buy in?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as you probably know, there's no magic answer to that.
Yeah.
So again, returning to fundamentals, but, you know, part of what I believe, time will enforce, meaning if you have the time and you will something, and again, will is very subjective, but if you have an element of unrelenting will, you can move things. And then, of course, if you return to those fundamentals of building belief and getting understanding, you want to have empathy for your staff, but not too much empathy, because you can almost become sympathetic toward your staff.
Right.
And if you have an unrelenting belief and you can look somebody in the eye, and really looking someone in the eye only goes so far, but if in terms of leadership, yes, they have to know you're in the trenches with them. They have to know that you can lead by example. So we were out on sales calls.
Consistently.
We were there. We were running. We were generals from the front.
Mm-hmm.
I think that carried a long way. The other part of that is you have to do what you say you're going to do, whatever it is. If you, the foundation of any relationship is trust.
Yep.
So people will slowly mold, change, adapt. Some did not. We lost some very good employees that stayed stuck and rooted in their print advertising and didn't want to move, or we couldn't, but we continued to move the majority of the company and transitioned ourselves to where by 2007 we were 100% digital, online, video, internet advertising company.
Wow, that's phenomenal transformation in a relatively short period of time, too.
Sure.
The
it helped that we were a small company. I mean, we were about 100 employees probably, give or take at that time.
So
still not a small number, but
exactly, but it's it so the you know, obviously being a successful entrepreneur, you know, you talked a little bit about the will and the belief that, you know, that you had, that Bob had, that, you know, your senior leadership team had.
Yeah.
How did you, or did you learn anything along the journey of how you take the, you know, that core strong knit of senior leaders, how do you transfer that to that workforce to really get them to take that same level of ownership? And when something doesn't go right, point the finger at themselves and say, hey, I need to move differently. I need to do something differently. Did you find it or learn anything along the lines that helped in that?
Again, I think it still goes back to those fundamentals, and I touched on it already, but it's leading by example.
Yeah.
So if I'm accountable to my team, and understanding, and most importantly, that we serve our coworkers, we serve our employees, they don't serve us. And then you start to get one or two people following, and then hopefully others follow them. And then the rewards have to be there as well.
Sure.
So there has to be visible signs of a difference, of improvement, but be it compensation, be it lifestyle, be it incentives, those things are all part of that mix. It's you can build a great belief in something, but if you're not delivering,
right,
the belief goes away. Like I said, they have to trust you.
Yeah.
So it's getting people to, and I guess getting people to believe. I think sometimes I did it through osmosis, quite frankly. I mean, I don't know that I was always conscious of it.
Yeah.
There's certain things, but I don't know that I can really articulate it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I think you've really pointed towards the most important thing, and that is it's in the example that you and the other senior leaders really showed that, you know, that caused people to buy in. Talk to us a little bit about the culture, too, that you guys have worked to create at CGI. You know, is that something that you thought about in the beginning of things? Is it something that developed over time? And what are you, kind of the key components that you think have helped make it so successful?
I think we were just, I don't know if it was the product of our environment. We just didn't we tried to not make excuses.
Yeah.
And that was something we tried to instill, and we still, to this day, we really work to accept the blame for when things didn't go well and not take too much credit for when things went well.
Right.
So that a lot of big egos, mine included. Mm-hmm. But if we try to remain humble when things are going well, and again, look at creating a culture of winning as a unit.
Yeah.
Whatever cliche, and they're cliches for a reason, but you go farther, you may go faster individually, but you'll go farther as a group.
Right.
And it's one thing to say that, but it's to demonstrate it.
Yeah.
And then along the line, you have people believing, but then there has to be some proof behind it.
Right.
And as you continue to build proof, then the core gets wider.
Yep.
And then you pick people up and it ebbs and flows in people. Mm-hmm. So I a big challenge is that you yourself can be a stalwart. You can be killing it. You may have personal challenges, life challenges, professional challenges. And we always talked about trying to silo those things, mm-hmm. which is extremely difficult. You have stuff going on in your personal life
that
bleeds into the workplace.
Yeah. But
we prided ourselves. It was almost a badge of honor,
right,
to be able to work through things.
Okay.
And that was a culture.
Yeah.
That was who we are. Right after 9/11, we decided we getting on a plane.
Yeah.
First, as soon as the airports opened up, we're not going to let the circumstances dictate our behavior.
Right.
We were going to let our behavior dictate our circumstances.
Yeah.
So that was a big mantra of ours as well in those years.
I love that. We're going to let our behavior dictate the circumstances.
Yeah.
What a wonderful way to turn it around.
Right. So
how did you talked a little bit about, the rewards have to follow the successes to perpetuate more mm-hmm. of the successes. So, talk to us a little bit about, that reward side of things. How did you use the rewards to, kind of pull the team together? Were there things that you found that seemed to, inspire people a little bit more outside of just, the paycheck kind of thing?
Sure, of course. So I think for most people, and everyone's a little different, mm-hmm. of course, but having some level of autonomy,
yep.
And feeling as though they have control over the outcome is critical.
Yeah.
I think for most people, feeling valued in what they're doing, they make a difference, and that they matter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important. It's extremely, it sounds pretty fundamental, but it's extremely important for leadership to value and recognize what their team is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early startup days of Next, I would be on our company intercom, shouting out record weeks. It was obnoxious. It really was. My team, I think, appreciated it.
Sure.
I loved doing it because I love the sound of my own voice. But it may have been somewhat obnoxious to some of the other people in the company at the time. But I was really tied into recognizing and a rewarding recognition, of course, was a big part of it. Giving people authority and responsibility is a big part of that. Trusting people. So what do I mean by trusting? Someone's giving you a proposal someone is making a recommendation about someone on their team, like they did to me today. They mm-hmm. had five people that they recommended, and I said, you don't have to talk to me about them because I don't know them well enough or their position well enough.
Right.
I trust you.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Give them whatever do what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about something else. And that's part of it, too. I think that's it. Showing trust and belief in them. You can't get trust and belief from them if you don't trust and believe in them.
Right.
So it's reciprocal.
So to that point, I was on a call this morning with a client. And they're working on this major transformation in terms of their organization. Part of the problem they're having is that they want to empower their people. They want their people to kind of step up and take that ownership. But there's an underlying fear in the minds of the people that, geez, if I do this and I screw it up, what's going to happen to me? So people are kind of waiting to be told what to do rather than taking the initiative.
Right.
So how do you create an environment where people feel safe to, you know, to try those things?
That too is a tricky thing, of course. It's really difficult to mandate change.
Yeah.
Or everybody, let's be empowered today and let's all run through the wall together because we know we can break through this wall. And, you know, at the same time, there might be a door that you can open the door and get to the other side. In terms of really making it safe for people, that has to come before that, in my opinion. Meaning people have to be encouraged and almost applauded for trying and failing.
Yeah.
And again, failure is only temporary.
Exactly.
Right? So, and it's a learning experience. And I, for one, I know that in 2007, I started a team, and it was a niche team inside of our flagship product. And we were very successful. And I wanted control over all of it, not necessarily because I'm a control freak, but I wanted to be responsible. I wanted to be accountable.
Sure.
Whether it was successful or not, I wanted the blame.
Right.
If it was bad, I wanted the blame. Not as much, but I still wanted the blame. But I also wanted the blame if we were doing well.
Sure.
So as part of that process of learning, I learned a bunch from it. It was successful, but not as successful as it could have been. It didn't. It wasn't sustaining. Perhaps I can. My ego will say it's because I left it.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is I didn't build it strong enough.
Right.
That's the real reality. That's the reality. So when 2010, 2011 rolled around, I had a really good sense of what I needed to do to instill a message. It really comes back again to the fundamentals, a clear expectations. People are afraid because they don't understand what to do. They're waiting to be told what to do because they don't really know, okay, what's the benefit of my taking this action?
Okay.
So there has to be some clarity. We can talk, we have all the opportunity in the world, but what does that opportunity mean to me in my position in this place where I have 5 or 6 or 7 senior people ahead of me? I don't ever see myself passing them or being on an equal plane with them.
Right.
So those require conversations and effective conversations to say, this is the path that, and then of course you cite examples and you can say, this is, and you need the people that were there to reinforce your story. They have to hear it from the people that were, as I mentioned again, this morning, we were in a conference room. At one time, that was the entire division.
Mm-hmm.
There are now 90 people.
Yeah.
But I said, this was the entire division. So if you were sitting here 10 years ago, you would be going, yeah, sure, I believe. Yeah, I have faith. Okay. And then you walk in here today and you go, oh, of course, it's matter of fact.
Right.
So it's instilling, you know, whatever the essence of faith and belief is. And that's really, and you need to have people reinforce your message. It has to be a consistent message. You have to work at it. You have to be paranoid about it. Culture is a very liquid, very ambiguous thing. You don't really know it's bad when it's bad. And you don't really know it's good. It just feels right.
Yeah.
And you think everything is cool. And it ebbs and flows. It's a living, breathing thing.
Yeah. I think that's such an important point, you know, and I think it's one that so often gets missed in organizations, the importance of really selling that vision and selling that picture to people of the
this
why.
This is what we can become.
Exactly. You know, it becomes sort of the, you know, today we're fighting this fire and tomorrow we're fighting that fire, but they never see the big picture.
Right.
And I think you're 100% right that, you know, that inherently is going to influence the fears that people have, the uncertainties that people have, all the negative stuff. So talk to me a little bit, you know, you've grown tremendously over the years. You've brought, you know, hundreds of people into the organization. How do you, and you've got, you know, you've got this very special culture that you've created. How do you kind of bring people into the organization and immerse them in that or you know, kind of, for lack of a better word, indoctrinate them into that?
Well, I think that's an area that we could probably improve on, truthfully, although we do, because there's formal elements of training, but It's done informally, and, okay. and probably the most critical part of that informal indoctrination is because we have so many right employees,
yeah.
they take it upon themselves to mentor.
Yep.
And, you know, and while we recognize the value in that, and we've encouraged that, we haven't formalized it. And
okay.
that's a conversation that's occurred over the years. It's something that as I'm sitting here now going, yeah, we got to revisit that again. Some things we did not cement as of yet, which I know would be a great catapult for our company as well as we are doing, mm-hmm. right? We could be so much better if we had a formal mentoring program. I think that's an area where we're weak, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's done, but it's done, as I said, informally. And when things are done informally, they're done happenstantially.
Yeah.
And that's a trap that many companies fall in. So you may have people doing it in some areas and not in others. You may have people doing it, but not doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when someone walks through our building in an interview, they pick up an energy
yeah.
and they like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then 6 months later, as we all do, we wake up and we're like, doubt creeps in.
Yeah.
And I think our number one job as, well, I don't know if it's the number one job, but it's certainly in the top five, destroying doubt.
Yeah.
Destroying doubt. And again, it all goes back to the fundamentals. If they don't believe you based on your actions,
mm-hmm.
forget the talk, because you can, everyone is pretty good at talking. But if doubt comes in, they may have doubt in their performance, they may have doubt in certain things and their own abilities, but if they have doubt in the company, if they
yeah.
have doubt in leadership, that just, it blows up,
mm-hmm.
essentially. It blows up. So you have to be able to...
It almost becomes a cancer that spreads,
sure,
too. Sure.
Right. So you have to really be able to understand that we're in a constant role of destroying doubt and trying to work with employees and understand the whatever the psychology is. But I often will say that it's how much pain are you willing to endure?
Right.
Because it's how we cope.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not so much that someone has more pain than someone else or more hurdles or more, because we all do.
Sure.
But it's how we cope, how we manage that, how you cope with rejection, how you cope with doubt, how you cope with being told you're feeling worthless.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Those are real human emotions that people go through. And
sure.
And so much of that is in the encoding of a message.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you can deliver to a room of individuals, and I could be talking to 30 people, and 20 of them might hear it this way.
Right.
And yes. But there's 10 people, and then there's 4 that really got a completely different message. So you have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
And you got to have your soldiers, you got to have your mentors reinforce a consistent message.
Yeah.
Well, whatever that message is.
And just making sure that they all know that same message, because you can see the power. I love how you said that, the kind of the ambassadors, if you will, of the organization. So, you know, you've got the senior leaders, but you've got other ambassadors who are there when you're not there,
mm-hmm.
and delivering that message when you're not delivering it. And so it sort of surrounds people, it feels like. So, you know, if I'm one of those folks and, you know, I'm battling those doubts or those inner demons, whatever they are, knowing that there are people around me who are, you know, helping with that, it almost feels like it would give you strength to figure out how do I get past those things.
Yeah, you try to make it as relatable as you can. And,
yeah.
and of course, we're a little older than, without saying how old I am, I will say that I'm older than the majority. Our average age is 27
yeah.
years old.
Yep.
So for me to think that I'm relatable
yeah.
to a 27-year-old borders on delusion.
Right.
I can relate as a parent,
mm-hmm.
perhaps. So it's understanding that. But we can all relate to certain things.
Right.
We can all relate to certain fears. We can, you know, I'm not living there like they have different fears than me, and I'm in a different wherever, and they're in, you know, I'm not worrying about student loans.
Right.
Right. But you know, we both can have dogs at the vet that we're concerned about.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so you try to find a common ground. And again, it comes back to serving our employees, helping them get what they want.
Yep.
If you really make helping people get what they want in all walks, in any part of life. And I have lived this and have been influenced by this greatly. But certainly when you find that, the rewards come back to you tenfold.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little bit of hindsight, of course, because you don't realize it at the time. So again, you have to trust some of those things that you're doing, but having that, giving up, the natural tendency for people is to not want to give something up. It's to hold on to it. It's to protect. This is my piece of the pie, and I want to control this. This is the job that I do really well. If I let somebody else do it, I'm not going to be as important. And you have to get people to understand that letting go of that actually creates more opportunity, not only for the rest of the company, but for themselves.
Yeah.
And they become better. And leadership struggles at the very top to bottom in any organization struggles with that, because so many of the things that I got there because of this and because of this, and this is the way I was, and this is what I did, and now you have to basically gift wrap it and hand it off.
Yeah.
And that's my baby, or that's I have my blood, sweat, and tears in that, and I need to do this because I'm the one, you know, and that actually is debilitating to the growth of an organization. So this company that is trying to make this broad sweeping change, the leadership has to be able to get out of the way in a sense too.
Yeah.
But they certainly have to build trust. And again, trust is not a mandate. Trust can't be built overnight. But it can be done, certainly. Yeah. And even if it's dysfunctional, I don't ever think, because I think everything is temporary. Like yep. I said, positive cultures are temporary. Negative cultures are temporary. It can be, there are thousands of examples throughout history of dysfunctional cultures that have been righted
right
through the will of leadership.
Yep.
And it's literally one stone at a time. We have an executive who does, and he does this all the time, but he does it was what his baseball coach taught him years ago. He played college baseball, but he would have a stack of nickels, mm-hmm. but there would be one crooked nickel in the stack. So if you ever try to stack nickels, they'll stack nice, but if you have a crooked nickel in there, what happens to the rest of the stack as you start to build on top of it? It topples over.
Right.
So I think, you know, the magic, again, for any company, every company should understand this. You want to cultivate and keep your great employees, and you have to make decisions to get the non-performers out.
Right.
And so often, that's a struggle, because you can have personal relationships
sure.
with non-performers.
Yeah.
And so in order to work through those things, you have to have clearly defined expectations so that people can be held accountable, so that you can feel and the leadership can feel and coaches can feel and mentors can feel like we gave that person every possible shot.
Right. It wasn't our failing, it was theirs.
And I've often said, you know, if you give 100%, you'll get 100% from me, from that guy, from that guy. So in essence, you're going to get about 1,000% if you put in your 100.
Yeah.
Because we're all going to fight for you if you're fighting for your job.
Right.
And that's, you know, and you don't always, you certainly don't identify that in an interview.
No.
You don't identify that, how someone is going to respond to change. We have it going on right now. We're moving offices and locations and, I'm comfortable. These are my friends.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to move. I embrace change.
Yeah. So
I want to grow. I want to evolve. But I want my friend right next to me.
Yeah. There's a Cheryl Adas, one of the wonderful lady who works with us. She said something to me, and you made me think of it. In a training class one time, she said, trying to remember how she, I want to make sure I don't misquote her. She said, whatever you hold on to ultimately holds you back.
Sure.
And
that's well said. What I said in my 3-minute dissertation.
well, her words, not mine. I just happened to. I was moved enough. Wow, that's profound, and yeah. I think
it takes a while to learn that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Because it's counterintuitive. It goes against human nature.
Because you have to get outside your comfort zones. You're right to let go in that sense of
trust.
Exactly, and trust and have faith that maybe this person you're handing something to won't do it as well as you will do it. At least not in the early phases. Mm-hmm. But if but the only way they'll ever get better at it is you have to give,
sure.
You have to allow them. So talk to us. You mentioned the recruiting phase because mm-hmm. that's really where it all starts. What do you guys look for when you're bringing people in? You mentioned, the average employee age, I think you said was 27. Likely you're bringing some people in right out of college, but it sounds like probably maybe more a little bit, and they got their feet
sure.
under them a little bit.
Yeah.
So what do you look for in the interviewing process?
So we like to see someone with a little bit of, call it, work-life perspective.
Sure.
So and we do hire college grads, but of course college grads don't have that real-life work experience.
Mm-hmm.
But we've done very well with we have interns that were interns 4, 5, 6 years ago that got jobs with us while in college and are our best employees today in our top 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real, but in terms of finding that person, it's all the intrinsic values.
Mm-hmm.
Believe very strongly that you can teach skills.
Yep.
And I, especially in our company, we're not engineers. We have video editors and we have videographers that require a certain skill, but even that skill can be taught.
Right.
So it's really trying to get the right mindset.
Yeah.
Right. What person has? What's the want to?
Mm-hmm.
And again, difficult to measure. But what's their desire to be part of a team? What's their? Are they coachable?
Right.
And give me proof of that. What have you done? When have you been at? Part of it is me, in an interview, I'll ask someone, what basically irks you off about your coworkers?
Okay.
And see if they'll give me an honest answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I have a lot of pet peeves.
Yeah.
I'll rattle. People that take credit for someone else's work drive me nuts. People that make excuses, not my favorite people, but I understand it. So trying to see, where that transparency is.
Uh-huh.
I don't think, in an interview specifically, we're you're sizing each other up
sure.
and everyone's putting their best foot forward. And the reality is if I'm telling you the truth and you're telling me the truth, then it's real easy to make a decision.
Sure.
I want to work for this company and I want you to work with this company.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, then it's, so I try to get to there, or
yeah.
I try to encourage my staff to get to there with the people they're hiring.
So to get people to let down their guard, because you're right, it's interviewing is a lot like dating, everybody is, putting their best foot forward in those early dates.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there any way that you guys have found to kind of let people get their guard down or to get a little more transparency into people when you're interviewing?
Well, I think I do what I just said.
I will
basically be that, and again, I try to have our team do that as well, but be that real with them. We also have people shadow the position prior to hiring. So again, it's all part of, this is what the job really is. This is not what I'm telling you. It's like, this is what it's like.
Okay.
And of course, when people are in a different environment and they're not being interviewed, they tend to be more open. So we're doing a circle interview without actually people knowing it, in a sense.
Right.
Right? Because they're sitting down with, and their guard is down just because they're, I'm just chilling with this person a little bit.
Yeah.
Looking at what they're doing from a work standpoint. So
okay.
We found that to be the shadowing part is really important for us, I think.
That makes perfect sense.
It eliminates a lot of the, I didn't know it was going to be like this.
Right, right. Well, and
there that works. That works for us. It may not work for all companies, but it certainly works for us.
But again, it goes back to what you said about, truth and honesty, and
mm-hmm.
So if you you know, if you set that tone, then you're more likely to get that same back from them, you know, and mm-hmm. and that's one of the things that it's kind of struck me in our conversation today is that, you know, you're very much an individual who, you know, you walk the walk, and it sounds like you've worked hard to create an organization that does the same. And so, you know, because of that, people model that in themselves. Sure.
You know, and while the recruiting process is important, I think the critical piece is certainly developing people, like we said, where you're willing to give up that influence or that direct authority so that, and then, you know, what's fun is when you turn around and understand that they are better than you, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, not be intimidated by that,
you know, and feel good about that,
and
feel good about helping quote unquote, get the best out of people. And the more you do that, obviously the company lifts and you end up individually with more influence because now you have people that are killing it. And that's a fun part of the work-life thing for sure.
Well, people can't help but be more loyal and dedicated. You know, they step back and they look at the difference that you've made. I mean, you talked about
the
it earlier.
The company has made.
Exactly. That the company has made in their life and really help them to get what it is they want, mm-hmm. you know, in their lives. And
for sure.
Inherently, you know, when somebody has done that for us or an organization has done that for us, we're more loyal, we're more dedicated, we're more bought in, you know, it becomes part of our family, sure. so to speak.
Again, we can't expect loyalty without giving it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it sounds so fundamental and so basic, but the idea that we should expect employees or customers or clients to be loyal to us if we are not loyal to them is absurd.
Yeah.
So you have to work at that. You have to work at culture.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time working on building people up and cementing our culture. You know, we're going to deliver the best customer experience possible for digital media, and we're going to control what we can control. I'm not going to worry about what the salesperson did and what was promised. We're going to control what we're going to deliver, and we're going to put a smile on the client's face. That's what we're going to be the best. We're going to be the best at that. We're going to have empathy for our coworkers. And I will often say at CGI, because we have those authority partners, we have three client categories. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a miss for a lot of companies. Our clients are our partners in our case. They're our business clients, which is the second category. And then there's our staff, our coworkers, our employees, are also part of our clients, mm-hmm. and we are here to serve them. And I think that isn't always so clear to people are you a leader or are you a boss? You know, we can get into that whole thing, but, you know, a boss is telling people what to do. A leader is obviously bringing people along, and I think that's really important. Yeah. I think, and the way you do that is by serving your people.
Yeah.
Not always easy. And listen, again, this is all talk right here.
Yeah.
The talk part is quite simple. It's putting it into action, which is obviously the challenge.
Yeah. I love what you said earlier about, you know, really one of the ways you do that, and as an organization you do that, is attacking the doubt. Because I think that's a piece that is so often overlooked in organizations is that, you know, it's that doubt, the insecurities, all of that,
sure.
that causes people to move the way they move, positive or negative.
Right.
And so just taking the time to recognize that's the real enemy. And how are we going about attacking
sure.
that doubt?
I think raw empathy
is
a good place to start.
Yeah.
I'd say. And being vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
right? You as a leader, you as a mentor, you as a coach, whatever, being vulnerable and saying, hey, not only do I understand that you may feel that way, but I feel that way or I have felt that way. And let's talk about ways that we can manage that or understand that 90% of the stuff that we're all worrying about never happens.
Yeah.
You know, and let's think about that a minute and let's really see where you've had a life experience that you can draw from that gets you through that.
Yeah.
Because that's really what we are. We're the sum of our life experiences, right?
Was that something that was always easier for you to have that empathy, or was that something you had to kind of learn?
No, I think instinctively we communicate, and I learned a lot of this at Too Logical, if I can say that. Yeah. But
a little impromptu plug there, but we'll let it slide.
So I was not conscious or aware of it. And I understood in myself, we all tend to lead people the way we like to be led.
Right.
And that when you think about it, it makes sense that that doesn't work for everyone.
Sure.
So because my, you know, because I was, passionate or short-tempered, depending on how you viewed it, or mm-hmm. or intense or whatever. And I was like, just tell me what to do. I'll go, you want me to go through the wall? All right. Not everybody responds to certain types of leadership. Some mm-hmm. people need to be patted on the back. Other people need to be kicked in the butt.
Right.
Some people respond. Some people are better at delivering messages. Some people are better at accepting messages. So being aware of that, so that developing that empathy mm-hmm. was challenging because I just felt everyone felt the way I did.
Sure. Yeah.
So why aren't they just responding? I would do that. If someone told me that, I would just go do that. And that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. So really trying to understand, as I said earlier, having empathy, but not being so sympathetic that you don't expect people to move.
Right. Then
the tail wags the dog, yeah. in a sense.
Yeah, well, point. It's their self-doubts start to rule at that point in time.
Right.
So you can't, you can't, if you buy the fact that they can't succeed, then that inherently is going to cause you to move certain ways.
Right.
And,
right.
But if you truly believe in them and you truly believe in their capabilities, then it's, okay, I understand where you're coming from. Let me help you get to mm-hmm. a better place.
Sure.
So if you don't mind, let's go a little deeper on that because I'm kind of curious because that's a big thing, I think, for leaders here's what's going through. I remember one of our folks, John Casey, he shared I think it was David Barr, who at the time was the CEO of Baker Hughes. He had come into a meeting that we were doing, I think it was in Dubai, and he was kind of addressing the group, and he if I remember it, he was talking about something he called new manager's disease. And he said there are two symptoms, or two conditions of new manager's disease. He said first is the fundamental belief that you have to know everything, and second is the belief that you have to be tough to get anything done. Mm. He said, and what I've learned is that both of those things are fundamentally false. And so I think that being vulnerable is something that for many people it's a very difficult thing because then it's
indicative of weakness.
Exactly.
Sure. And we as leaders don't want to appear weak.
Yep.
And certainly, so again, instinctively we try to say, oh, we have the answers because everyone's looking at us for answers, and if we don't have an answer. But again, so that is a fundamental flaw of many leaders, certainly, and they feel that they have to provide and have to know the answer. But again, I think you, as much as you understanding where your team sits, if they understand where you are, that you don't have all the answers and that but you're confident, and I say this oftentimes, I'm a confident person, but a great deal of the confidence that I have is because of the team I have around me. I'm extremely confident in what they're capable of, and I think I feel that they believe that when I say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, I try to walk the walk and all those fun things. But so when you have that and you can truly be like, hey, what could I have done better there?
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel I needed to do better there rather than just critiquing them? And you are open to true feedback. If you can build a team that you trust and they trust you where they can actually critique their boss to some extent,
yeah,
it's a great thing, in my opinion, because self-reflection is paramount for anybody in life, I think. And,
yeah.
And looking inward and looking at things and really simply, of course, looking at it and saying, okay, yep, these are a lot of things I did great, but what did I do poorly? And of course, what can I change? Yeah. And getting people to understand that and see that and understand that they've done it in their lives, their entire life.
Sure.
But really trying to give, it's really about trying to give people formulas,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's almost like you had a combination to a safe and you're trying to find the, and every combination for every person is different.
Right.
There may be similarities, but you're trying to unlock the safe.
Yeah.
And you try to connect. It's fun.
So to that point, and I think you're 100% correct. The value of self-reflection is woefully underrated. And people, they love to focus on when they, hit the home run or when they, turned in the great sale or whatever it is, but don't spend anywhere near enough time taking the time to really reflect and, well, why did that come together the way it did and what can I learn from that? And equally as valuable when things don't turn out well, why didn't they turn out well and how can I do it differently or how can I do it better next time?
Mm-hmm.
So is there a formula that you've found?
That I think you just hit on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly. The formula at its very simplest form is to look at what went right. What did, not only what went right with this outcome, what went right with past outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging though, because things aren't always easily repeatable.
Sure.
So because you were successful at one time, it's very difficult to recreate the same aura, chemistry.
Yep.
But there still are foundational elements of that will foundationally ring true. But you look at what you do well. Of course, it's looking at what you did poorly without beating
right
each other up.
Yep.
And making it a bitch session, quite frankly.
Sure.
Because that doesn't really serve any purpose. But if people understand that you're looking to see what we can do better.
Yeah.
Because then it becomes an act of self-improvement.
Right.
Not a critique of you're a horrible person and a horrible human being.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
You have to depersonalize it, I think. Yeah. I think it's more about actions and less about self-worth.
Right, sure, exactly. And I think that's where we instinctively, when we say, what did we do wrong? The behavior was wrong.
It's right.
Same thing with parenting. Right?
Yeah.
It's not, you're not a horrible child. You just, that behavior is unacceptable.
Right.
What can we do to improve it? And, I think those are all things that we need to learn. And part of that learning is a desire for learning. It's a desire for wanting to get better. There are a lot of people that don't necessarily, I shouldn't say a lot, but there are people that don't want to get better.
Yeah.
So,
or maybe they don't believe they can.
Right. Well, that too. But there has to be a willingness. And if people are willing, then that's fun. And then and those are the people I prefer to be around, of course. Like, who doesn't?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said it earlier in the conversation. It's, it's always in the want to, and if somebody has that want to, they've got that burning desire in their gut, there's not going to be the lot that stops them. I mean, undoubtedly, for you and for Bob in those early phases, that burning desire is what fueled the start of the company.
And continues it.
Exactly.
More importantly.
Yeah.
And that's and again, this is part of it, right? People have successes. Coworkers have successes. And it's always getting to that point and then, having to, now that you're there, how do you go to the proverbial next level?
Right.
And it's whatever that is for you. Like for me, one of the things that gets me out of bed is my commitment to the folks that I work with, my promises. Whatever early on, it was more about, they told me I couldn't do this.
Right.
They didn't think I could do it. They didn't think I was good enough. And whether it was true or not, I convinced myself that that was what was happening. So I had a chip on my shoulder. And then, there's different elements now. Now it's, as I said, wanting to prove to people that they made the right decision to hitch their wagon, so to speak, to CGI.
Yeah.
And that's an important piece. I don't want to let people down.
And I think you bring up a great point. So often people, they you know, they have a picture in their own mind of something they want to achieve or something they want to accomplish, and they get there, and then they're kind of standing going, okay,
well,
yeah, exactly. And they just spin, you know, and they don't feel the enthusiasm, they don't feel the burning desire, the passion that they once did, because they never reset the bar.
Right.
And you know, I love where you reset the bar, where, you know, okay, it's not so much about now, you know, proving that, yeah, I can do it. Now it's about, I want, you know, I don't want to let all these other people around me down. And I want, you know, I want to see them succeed and see the difference. And you know what? To me, that's the real essence of leadership.
Yeah, it feels a lot better even.
Doesn't it, though?
It does.
You know, you look around and you think about those men and women's lives,
mm-hmm.
and how different their lives are because they chose to become a part of your organization.
Yeah, I think one of the most fun and proud moments for me is as an organization, and while our average age is 27, but it's now when we have Bring Your Child to Work Day, it used to be like 8 kids, now it's like 80.
Uh-huh.
And so it's people buying homes, it's people building families, it's all of those kind of things. And to see a physical, visible, tangible proof of that is pretty sweet. And
yeah.
And while, you know, there's always the work-life balance, although when we were younger, Dave, there was no work-life. There was no such thing as work-life balance.
You never even heard the term before.
Yeah. What is this work-life balance? But you know, you see that and you go, wow, it's awesome to see the significant others and the spouses and and that it feels as though they're part of a family.
Yep.
It is. It's exceptionally rewarding to see that.
Yeah. So I'm curious, Frank, knowing what you know now and what you've learned through the journey, if you had to give, you know, the younger Frank advice when you were, you know, back in Connecticut before you moved to Rochester and you started the company, what advice would you give your younger self?
Ooh, golden nuggets. But so I think for me, having done a lot of self-reflection, I would have had to say, you know, I went through school and I was good with a B plus, without a lot of effort. Played sports, I was a decent athlete, but I was reluctant to really put myself fully out there to go for the A, to be the best player on the team, because I was afraid of failing.
Mm.
Took a lot to come to that. But, yeah, it was, I'm good here, but if I go for that and I don't get it, then what am I going to, you know, I have to rationalize something to back to myself. So I think I would convince myself, and I'd advise myself that failing is just part of the journey, and it was okay to do that stuff. I think that would be an important piece. I think I would certainly talk about managing doubt, and how to turn challenges into fuel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like a challenge, but there, you know, when you're getting beat up, and like I said, when doubt is, you know, creeping in, and you make it fun and you make the challenge fun and you make overcoming that challenge, and then you learn how to draw on life, and it's essentially saying, okay, I'm going to get through this, and building your own sense of self-worth when nobody else is.
Yeah,
I don't know how you convey that to somebody necessarily, but that's what I would tell myself.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, that's so much of that in
positive visualization.
Yeah.
I will get to this place.
Yeah.
I will get to this place. I see what I want to become, and keep that and let the subconscious mind do its thing a little bit. But trust in that.
Yeah.
And it's hard to trust when you're not doing well or you're struggling. But again, letting yourself know that 90% of what you worry about doesn't even happen.
Yeah.
And so having the benefit of hindsight, I probably would have shared those thoughts, I think.
Yeah. Well, and just, you know, that's what really allows someone to break away from being ruled by fear. And, you know, being, to your point, being ruled by that positive visualization and where you want to go instead of where you don't want to go.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that's, I think that's pretty good advice to give to young Frank, you know.
Now, if only we could take it back, because I would go back. Because as you know, the only thing we can't get back is time.
Exactly.
You can replace anything you want in life, but time is not one of those. And yeah. I think we'd all, even if I didn't know what I know now, I'd want to go back in time, I think.
Yeah. There's always those little things. You know, you appreciate things more or something.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. So, yeah, we're excited. Our next, and so as I mentioned in the very beginning, coming full circle, we recently acquired a company that has relationships with Better Business Bureaus and advertising and authority advertising. So it's, and while our journey is certainly not done, it certainly is there's a bit of a loop right there. And it's pretty wild to 30 years later be back in that environment again and to see just randomly how that, because that model has carried through our company and has been a foundation for us. And so it's kind of a nice little footnote. Yeah. CGI's story, I guess.
Very, very cool. Well, Frank, thank you so much for coming in and
happy to do it.
Sharing your wisdom today. There's no doubt in, you know, in listening to your words, the reasons why the organization has been as successful as it has, and it really does. It comes back to great leadership.
Well, appreciate that. And yeah. As I said, I enjoyed it and look forward to obviously more of these. This was fun.
There you go. Oh, right. So good. Thank you, Frank.
Bet. Thanks a lot, guys.
Hey guys, one more thing before you take off. This is Motivational Intelligence Insider. It's just a very short, exclusive email every Monday that comes from Dave, John, and the guests on this show. This is the only place they share their very, very best stuff, and it's delivered right to your inbox every single Monday. This could include exclusive tips for upping your game, articles they're reading, videos they're watching, stories from the road, and on and on. It's the best way to kick off your week, and this content is comes directly from Dave, John, and the guests, and is only available to subscribers of Motivational Intelligence Insider. So if you want these guys and gals to email you their best stuff, go to twological.com/insider. That's the number 2logical.com/insider, and drop in your email. And if you do, I hope you enjoy.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at Two Logical. Two Logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. Two Logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with. Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs or just want to say hey, head over to twological.com.